Hello there, and welcome back to Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and instructions are studied in their natural environment and occasionally shot dead in the name of closer observation. Today we're continuing our world-building series with a look at a book that taught me historical fiction can not only be fun, it can also have dragons in it. A Natural History of Dragons by Marie Brennan originally caught my eye because of the interesting cover art, an anatomical sketch of a dragon describing bone structure, musculature, and hide patterns. It caught my attention so thoroughly that I was halfway through the book before I even realized I just had to own it for myself. It needed to be on my shelf. But let me tell you, if someone had just described the book to me without showing me the cover, I might not have picked it up. Why? Because it's explicitly marketed as a fictional memoir. Here's the pitch from the back cover, as provided by Amazon. You, dear reader, continue at your own risk. It is not for the faint of heart, no more than the study of dragons itself. But such study offers rewards beyond compare. To stand in a dragon's presence, even for the briefest of moments, even at the risk of one's life, is a delight that, once experienced, can never be forgotten. All the world, from Skirland to the farthest reaches of Eriga, know Isabella, Lady Trent, to be the world's preeminent dragon naturalist. She is a remarkable woman who brought the study of dragons out of the misty shadows of myth and misunderstanding into the clear light of modern science. But before she became the illustrious figure we know today, there was a bookish young woman whose passion for learning natural history and, yes, dragons, defied the stifling conventions of her day. Here, at last, in her own words, is the true story of a pioneering spirit who risked her reputation, her prospects, and her fragile flesh and bone to satisfy her scientific curiosity, of how she sought true love and happiness despite her lamentable eccentricities, and of her thrilling expedition to the perilous mountains of Vistrana, where she made the first of many historic discoveries that have changed the world forever. There's just enough of the stuffy academic journalist in this pitch that I can imagine it was written by someone who was trying to appeal to the public audience, but maybe doesn't quite have the hang of what normal people like. And at the same time, old-fashioned enough that it sounds like something that could have been printed 200 years ago. At the same time, these are impressions rather than a direct representation, so it's easily understood by a modern audience while preserving that oldish, stuffy-ish feeling. 10 out of 10, I couldn't have done it better, and I'm not even sure I could have done it as well myself. I've never been terribly good at giving the impression of stuffiness without being actually overbearingly stuffy. But you can see, I think, why this book appealed to me so much. I mean, dragon naturalist? Is there any better way to capture my attention? Still, I think this book, the whole series really, has much more to offer than simply pushing my specific readerly buttons. For one thing, I think the narrator herself, who presents the story in first person, this is a memoir after all, is snarky and charming and lively in a way that I've seen in my own friends and family. Let me show you what I mean. A Natural History of Dragons by Marie Brennan. Preface. Not a day goes by that the post does not bring me at least one letter from a young person, or sometimes not so young, who wishes to follow in my footsteps and become a dragon naturalist. Nowadays, of course, the field is quite respectable, with university courses and intellectual societies putting out fat volumes titled Proceedings of Some Meeting or Other. Those interested in respectable things, however, attend my lectures. The ones who write to me invariably want to hear about my adventures, my escape from captivity in the swamps of Mulin, or my role in the Great Battle of Kayanga, or, most frequently, my flight to the inhospitable heights of the Murchiahaima Peaks, the only place on Earth where the secrets of dragonkind could be unlocked. Even the most dedicated of letter writers could not hope to answer all these queries personally. I have therefore accepted the offer of Messrs. Kerrigan and Rudge to publish a series of memoirs chronicling the more interesting portions of my life. By and large, these shall focus on those expeditions which led to the discovery for which I have become so famous. But there shall also be occasional digressions into matters more entertaining, personal, or even, yes, salacious. One benefit of being an old woman now, and moreover one who has been called a national treasure, is that there are very few people who can tell me what I may or may not write. Be warned, then. The collection of volumes in this series will contain frozen mountains, fetid swamps, hostile foreigners, hostile fellow countrymen, the occasional hostile family member, bad decisions, misadventures in orienteering, diseases of an unromantic sort, and a plentitude of mud. You continue at your own risk. It is not for the faint of heart, no more than the study of dragons itself. But such study offers rewards beyond compare. To stand in a dragon's presence, even for the briefest of moments, even at the risk of one's life, is a delight that once experienced can never be forgotten. If my humble words convey even a fraction of that wonder, I will rest content. We must, of course, begin at the beginning. Before the series of discoveries and innovations that transformed the world into the one you, dear reader, know so well. In this ancient and nearly forgotten age lie the modest origins of my immodest career, my childhood and my first foreign expedition to the mountains of Vistrana. The basic facts of this expedition have long since become common knowledge, but there is much more to the tale than you have heard. Isabella, Lady Trent, Castlethwaite, Lynshire, 11 Floris, 5658. This preface is not unlike one we might read in an actual memoir. The author, or speaker, as the case may be, warning us about what lies within the covers of the book we're about to embark on reading. This approach to the fictional world as a real place with real people and an audience that needs to be catered to, I don't have words for how much I love this. It's fantastic. I've mentioned on more than one occasion that the more your characters act as if the world they live in is a real place, the more your readers will experience your story rather than just reading it. This series goes another step further and invites the audience into the fictional world, making them a part of the audience in the same way you might expect from an in-universe textbook published to real people. It makes them part of the world, and there's nothing I would love more, honestly, than living in a world where dragons are real. That's some good stuff. We have time for one more section, so I'm going to read a bit from the first chapter here to see if we can learn a little more about the world other than, you know, there being dragons in it and us being part of it. Let's dig in. Part 1, in which the memoirist forms a youthful obsession with dragons and engineers an opportunity to pursue that obsession. 1. Greeny, an unfortunate incident with a dove, my obsession with wings, my family, the influence of Sir Richard Edgeworth. When I was 7, I found a sparkling that the groundskeeper had not yet cleared away, lying dead on a bench at the edge of the woods which formed the back boundary of our garden. With much excitement, I brought it for my mother to see, but by the time I reached her, it had mostly collapsed into ash in my hands. Mama exclaimed in distaste and sent me to wash. Our cook, a tall and gangly woman who nonetheless produced the most amazing soups and souffles, thus putting the lie to the notion that one cannot trust a slender cook, was the one who showed me the secret of preserving sparklings after death. She kept one on her dresser top, which she brought out for me to see when I arrived in her kitchen, much cast down from the loss of the sparkling and from my mother's chastisement. "However did you keep it?" I asked her, wiping away my tears. "Mine fell all to pieces." "Vinegar," she said. And that one word set me upon the path that led to where I stand today. If found soon enough after death, a sparkling, as many of the readers of this volume no doubt know, may be preserved by embalming it in vinegar. I sailed forth into our gardens in determined search, a jar of vinegar crammed into one of my dress pockets so the skirt hung all askew. The first one I found lost its right wing in the process of preservation, but before the week was out, I had an intact specimen, a sparkling 1.5 inches in length, his scales deep emerald in color. With the boundless ingenuity of a child, I named him Greeny, and he sits on a shelf in my study to this day, tiny wings outspread. Sparklings were not the only things I collected in those days. I was forever bringing home other insects and beetles, for back then we classified sparklings as an insect species that simply resembled dragons, which today we know to be untrue. And many other things besides. Interesting rocks, discarded bird feathers, fragments of eggshells, bones of all kinds. Mama threw fits until I formed a pact with my maid that she would not breathe a word of my treasures, and I would give her an extra hour a week during which she could sit down and rest her feet. Thereafter, my collections hid in cigar boxes and the like, tucked safely into my closets where my mother would not go. If there is one drawback to treating the audience as though they lived in the fictional world your story takes place in, it's that explaining the world would then be entirely unbelievable. It would break the immersion of including your readers as part of the world, and you lose all the benefit that glorious opening gave us. This being the case, it makes sense that there are a limited number of genres in which this technique is of any use at all. That is, it would only function in stories concerning worlds that are like our own. Urban fantasy, if we consider it a genre at all, is ideal for this, as the world is just like ours, only with some fantastical elements which can be explored, such as by giving your main character a passion for learning about them at a young age. This series, being in a world like to our own, with different names and dragons added, would qualify as urban fantasy, I think. Though I tend to label it as historical fantasy, as I did earlier, just to avoid the confusion associated with urban fantasy usually taking place in the modern day. There are certain details in this introduction, such as the relative isolation associated with countryside properties, and the strict expectations on girl children, that indicate this is a period that reflects the social development of our own world some 2 or maybe even 3 centuries ago. It's not a lot to go on, but it's enough that we as readers have a pretty good idea of what the world generally looks like. Plus dragons. This is a very subtle form of world building, using the shortcuts of implying our world is very like theirs, and then expounding on the unfamiliar elements to flesh out how their world is different than ours. The lack of exposition here would qualify this method as the implied world building, and obviously from the inside out, from the perspective of a character inside the world. You know, I'm starting to see a trend in the sort of books I think do good world building. You know, let's come back next week and see if this trend continues. That's all I have for you today. The random question of the day is it worth it to you to return a gift for the same article in the correct size, or is it more likely that the gift in question will just sort of drift to the back of your closet and never be seen again? Until next time, keep on keeping on, my Inklings. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a fantastic audience. I'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening to Catawampus Readings. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you're interested in supporting Catawampus Readings and would like early access to new episodes, you can sign up to donate monthly at patreon.com/inkfire. Special thanks to our patrons, Corvus, Valkyrie, and Barry Marie.